Thank you. Let me say two things before I get started. One, I feel kind of strange being wedged in between Eric Walker and Michael Roos, but I'll try and survive that. The other is that there have been so many interesting things said already this morning. I feel like my paper has already been given, but maybe there's a few nuances that I can get into. I'm using Mozart kind of as an example and as an icon, and you'll see why as we go. So I'd like to start off by just giving you a few vignettes that come from Mozart's time about Mozart. And these are ones that we actually have documentation for. The first few are about the young Mozart. As you probably know, that stories about Mozart's musical capabilities from an early age are legion. By the time he was 4 years old, Mozart could learn not only play the clavier, but it would take him about half an hour to learn a piece. Next to a piece in a music book that Mozart used, his father Leopold wrote, "This minuet and trio were learned by Wolfgangerl, and I might say that if you ever saw the movie Amadeus, he was never called Wolfie, in half an hour, not to be too precise, but at 9:30 at night on 26 January 1761, one day before his fifth birthday." 3 months after his fifth birthday, Mozart composed his first piece, a minuet and trio in G, and we know the date of that because Leopold again recorded it. And if you're interested, here's the piece. This is played on a clavichord, which is an instrument that was used a fair amount in the 18th century. It's not exactly a harpsichord, but I think it comes across okay. Player did add a few ornaments that wasn't in the original, but you know, this is not bad for a kid that was 3 months past 5 years old to compose. Okay. Leopold Mozart, his father, was a musician himself, a court composer at the court of the Archbishop Count Colloredo in Salzburg, and a noted violinist. When Wolfgang was a little older, that is, when he was 5 years old, Leopold was rehearsing a trio with two court musicians, Andreas Schachner and a Herr Wenzel. After Mozart's death, Schachner wrote to Mozart's sister, Anna Maria, who is known as Nonnerl, about an incident that occurred. Wolfgang, it seems, was hanging around with a little miniature violin his father had given him, but had not received any lessons on the violin. The letter picks up. Wolfgangerl asked to be allowed to play second violin. Your papa reproved him and thought he would be unable to make anything of it. Wolfgang said, "You do not need to have lessons to play second violin." When your papa insisted that he go away and not bother us, he began to cry and went sulkily off with his little fiddle. I asked that he be allowed to play alongside of me. At last your papa said, "Play with Herr Schachner, but so softly that you can't be heard or you'll have to go." Soon I noticed, to my amazement, that I was superfluous. Quietly I laid my violin aside and watched your papa, who had tears of wonder and pleasure running down his cheeks. We played through all six trios. When we finished, Wolfgangerl was so elated by our applause that he said he could play the first violin part. We let him do it for a joke and almost died of laughter. His fingering was incorrect and improvised, but he never got stuck. Soon Leopold realized that his son was special and decided to take advantage of his prodigious talent. From the time Mozart was 6 years old until his mid-teens, he was constantly on the road, performing throughout Europe before courts and royalty. Everywhere he went, Mozart astounded all listeners. Exactly what he did may be seen from a promo letter that Leopold sent out to various courts. It should be noted that Mozart, again, was older when this letter was written. He was 7 at the time. And by the way, that's a picture of Mozart at the clavier, his father Leopold there with the violin, and his older sister Nannerl, who was singing. The boy will play a concerto on the violin, accompany symphonies on the clavier, completely cover the manual or keyboard of the clavier, and play on the cloth as well as though he had the keyboard under his eyes. And this goes on. And this is another picture. You can barely see Wolfgang. He's getting ready to accompany a singer who's tuning a guitar, and you see this little kid sitting at the clavier. He will further most accurately name from a distance any notes that may be sounded for him either singly or in chords, on the clavier or on every imaginable instrument, including bells, glasses, and clocks. Lastly, he will improvise out of his head, not only on the pianoforte, but also on the organ. Another gift of Mozart's was his musical memory. Probably the most famous example occurred when Mozart was 14. He and his father traveled to Italy, and in Rome, they visited a certain chapel where the choir frequently performed a miserere by Gregori Allegri. It was a long, polyphonic composition, jealously guarded by the chapel. It was not printed, and no copy of it was allowed outside the chapel. Mozart heard it once, and went home and wrote the entire piece down. Now, there's some story that he heard it a second time, and then realized that he hadn't gotten it right. He had 3 notes wrong or something like that. But that story is not completely confirmed. A letter from Leopold to his wife, that is Mozart's mother, confirms that this story is not apocryphal. You have often heard of the famous Miserere in Rome, which is so greatly prized that the performers in the chapel are forbidden on pain of excommunication to take away a single part of it, to copy it, or to give it to anyone. But we have it already. Wolfgang has written it down, and we would have sent it to Salzburg in this letter if it were not necessarily for us to be there to perform it. I'm not sure what that phrase means. So we shall bring it home with us. Moreover, as it is one of the secrets of Rome, we do not wish to let it fall into other hands. When Frau Mozart expressed concern that this feat might get them into trouble, Leopold assured her, "There is not the slightest cause for anxiety. All Rome, and even the Pope himself, knows that he wrote it down. There is nothing whatever to fear. On the contrary, this achievement has done him great credit." Clearly, from these accounts, Mozart must have been a musical genius, and 20th century scholars have agreed. That's a fairly recent book. Based on what I have presented, however, he is not, at least according to the Enlightenment. He may be a genius, but that would depend on other factors. In the past 200 plus years, there have been at least 3 different conceptions of musical genius, and even though considerable overlap exists, it is important to separate them. I'm going to ignore the arrow of time and travel backwards from the modern to the romantic and finally the Enlightenment view. I won't say much about the modern idea of genius. It is used so frequently and so vaguely that it almost defies definition. Any musician, be it classical, pop, or even country, anyone that does anything out of the ordinary is considered a musical genius. Charlie Parker, John Cage, Jerry Lee Lewis, Madonna, George Jones, Stevie Wonder, to name just a few, were at one time or another called geniuses. You may be relieved to know that, to my knowledge, that term has never been applied to Britney Spears. So, more pertinent, more clearly defined, and more relevant to the symposium, however, as well as to American musical culture, is the romantic view of genius. Edward E. Lewinsky, One of the first modern scholars to explore this concept in detail, that is of musical genius, observed that historians who often study the concept often leave out music. He cited an earlier but influential German work, Edgar Zitzel's Die Entstehung des Genie-Begriffes, as an example. Now, I think Olovinsky's observation is dated. He was writing in the 1960s. But determining musical genius specifically still presents special problems. The German critic and writer of the early 19th century, E.T.A. Hoffmann, saw genius in romantic terms, a composer who captures in a moment of ecstasy what the unconscious mind received. Effective composition is nothing but the art of capturing with a higher strength and fixing in the hieroglyphics of tones, that is the notes, what was received in the mind's unconscious ecstasis. Hoffmann does acknowledge that technical training will allow what the mind perceived to be cast into tones more easily, but that is not what counts. What matters is that fire of creation that occurs in the soul. Hoffmann was not alone. In 1826, Peter Lichtenthal, in his Dictionary and Biography of Music, wrote, "Musical genius is that inborn, inexplicable gift of nature, our original faculty to create with facility aesthetic ideas. It is that inner fire that burns in the composer, which continuously inspires him in new and beautiful melodies." I'll get back to that term, melody, shortly. "Lively expressions that go to the heart, and majestic harmonies that endow the melody with character." Auguste Goethe, in his Musical Conversational Lexicon in 1840, wrote, "Genius is a driving power, a divine instinct, guided by a divine thoughtfulness." We've heard a lot about this divine issue earlier, and here it's popping up again. In all of these, genius is a gift from God, or somewhere in the universe, the possessor having been born with it. This concept in music goes back to Rousseau, who opened his Dictionnaire de Musique with the statement, "Don't ask young artists what is genius. Either you have it, then you feel it yourself, or you don't, then you will never know it." This, of course, is actually reminiscent of Louis Armstrong. Once he was asked, "What is jazz?" And his response was, "Man, if you gotta ask, you ain't never gonna know." And I assume he wasn't consciously quoting Rousseau at that point. Chronologically, and with his connections to the encyclopedists in France, Rousseau was squarely within the Enlightenment orbit. But more than most 18th century writers, however, his ideas resonated with the Romantics, and his thoughts on musical genius is especially close to that of Romanticism. There was one important development in the 19th century, however, that Rousseau did not foresee. Changes in the production and dissemination of music fundamentally altered how the musical genius was perceived. The 18th century musician was, by today's standards, a jack of all trades. He, and I use the masculine form here purposely, usually had a position at court or church in which he was responsible for making music happen. He created it when necessary. He performed on what instruments were needed. He conducted whatever ensembles were required. Virtually all professional musicians had a job to do. They were employees who produced whatever music the patron needed or wanted. Haydn, for instance, wrote 175 baritone trios. And there's a picture of a baritone. The baritone was an awkward string instrument, a member of the viol family that's mostly obsolete today, that is outside the early music revival. Now, it is hard to imagine Haydn burning with too much fire of inspiration for this instrument, especially when forced to write parts that were not too difficult. But Prince Esterhazy liked to play it, so 175 trios it was. Similarly, Mozart started many pieces that were never completed. Why Mozart abandoned them puzzled early scholars. They have all the appearance of a successful composition, and we know that Mozart never got stuck. In almost all cases, a commission or reason for its performance fell through, so he felt no artistic compulsion to complete them. He simply moved on to the next piece. With the rise of the middle class in the 19th century, the court patroning system gave way to the world of the modern public concert. A simultaneous rise in music publishing, greatly aided by incipient copyright laws that allowed a composer to make money from sales of printed music, the expansion of instrument manufacture, especially pianos, which resulted in large number of performing amateurs, and the rise of the touring virtuoso created a place for a composer to survive mainly as a composer. Most virtuosi composed, but virtually all needed more music than either their talents or their schedules would allow. The change began with Beethoven, whose physical malady forced him into the role of composer. It should be noted that Beethoven was one of the first composers who insisted on being thought of as a Tonkünstler rather than a componist, and that he survived by being as unscrupulous in his business dealings as the publishers who tried to prey off of him. Beethoven also demonstrated that a composer can be isolated and succeed, and aided by these changes in the musical world as a whole, the composer as a separate entity came into existence. For various reasons, Schubert, Schumann, Chopin fulfilled that role, although Schumann's music got a boost through his wife, who was a highly successful concert pianist. Because the composer was often removed from the performance of his composition, a mystique could develop around him. This was further enhanced by what has been called the sacralization of music, the emergence of a canon of great works which by their elevated tone, were believed to have deep spiritual meaning, to go beyond mere entertainment, to embrace ethical values that contributed to making a better person of the listener. This notion may still be found in some circles today. It almost goes without saying that such pieces were considered inspired, a sense that extended to the composer himself. The 19th century saw a cult of genius grow around the isolated composer, the distant figure who somehow connected through tones. The virtuoso, while admired, was considered to be on a lower plane. His abilities were often equated to little more than circus tricks, except when he communicated the elevated thoughts of the great master composer. Then he was the messenger, not the creator of the message. Liszt, who was both a brilliant pianist and a composer of the first rank, had an ambivalent reputation. Many were inspired by what he wrote and played, but many heard in his compositions empty bombast and self-aggrandizement. Chopin fared better, in part because he was too shy and sickly to live the life of a touring virtuoso. He was almost never before the public. Beethoven became the quintessential genius for the 19th century. Few paintings capture better the romantic attitude toward musical genius than the Joseph Donhauer's painting of a gathering listening to Liszt. Now, if you, I don't have a laser pointer, but if you'll note, you'll notice you have. Oh, thank you. Great. Thank you. Yes. Oh, wonderful. Thanks. It's kind of interesting the way this is organized. You have two groups of three figures. These three figures over here are all literary figures. This person is usually identified as Alexandre Dumas, but I've actually heard someone try and say it was Lamartine, but I don't think so. This is George Sand. This is Hugo. And then here we have the three musicians. This is Paganini. This is Rossini. And then, of course, Liszt at the piano. And then here we have Countess Marie Agoult, who was Liszt's long-term mistress and also the mother of Liszt's daughter, I might add, Cosima, who married Richard Wagner. But of course, dominating this whole thing is this bust of Beethoven. Let me pick this up. First of all, is this a large bust? I mean, is this sitting on the window or the piano, or is it the specter in the window? It's hard to tell. And if you notice, most of the eyes are either on, in some cases, on list, but most of all, looking kind of in the distance, this person, there are maybe even up at Beethoven. But most important, Liszt is clearly fixated on Beethoven, his inspiration as he plays at the piano. Thank you. Okay. Now, I stress the composer-genius connection because if we turn to the Enlightenment view, we find a scenario that is somewhat different. Music theorists in the 18th century were groping to explain instrumental music. The idea that instrumental music imitated the voice, long the explanation for it, no longer seems sufficient for some of the more elaborate instrumental forms, particularly the symphony and, to some extent, the concerto. Writers distinguished between two styles at the time, the sonata style and the symphony style, which, by the way, were somewhat independent of genre. The sonata style, befitting the solo performance that gave it its name, was more intimate and could be discussed within the concept of imitation. Heinrich Koch, the most important theorist to grapple with the problem of instrumental music, stated, "In a sonata, the composer can strive to create a monologue in terms of sadness, grief, tenderness, or of joy and delight, or sustain a sensitive dialogue in impassioned tones of equal or contrasting character, or simply depict powerful, stormy, contrasting, or light, soft, fluent, and pleasing emotions." Notice the terms, monologue and dialogue. Daniel Gottlieb Türk echoed this idea. But the more expressive the sonata, the more it sounds as if the composer is speaking in tones, and the more the composer knows how to avoid common terms, the more excellent the sonata. The symphony was characterized more by grand sweeping gestures, a more exalted tone, and more power and drive. This was easy to observe, but more difficult to explain. Theorists focused mostly on the structure of instrumental music, and if we read Koch's three-volume explanation, something I don't necessarily recommend, he spends most of his time on precisely that. He goes into great detail about the construction of phrases, sections, cadences, and the overall harmonic and formal pattern. But he still desired to explain the difference between the two styles and what within each style made them effective. He knew the difference did not lay in form. The forms of the sonata and the symphony might be similar to one another in appearance, the number of periods, and the conduct of the modulations. In contrast, the two differ in the inner nature of melody. This difference can be better felt than described. With that statement, Koch and other theorists ran into trouble. How do you explain melody? In the second volume of his Versuch, Koch distinguished between what he called the inner and outer dimension of melody, the innere Beschaffenheit and the äußerliche Beschaffenheit. By the outer dimension, he meant the mechanical rules for phrase structure, cadences, the period, and so on. These rules, explained in the second part of Volume 2, have been discussed frequently in the modern literature on classical style and form and are still taught in music theory classes today. The inner nature of melody, however, the expressive aspect, which is treated in the first part of Volume 2, has been largely neglected by scholars, even though Koch explicitly considered the expressive element the most important aspect of the piece. The problem lay with Koch himself. Unable to reach any specific conclusions, he finally put down his quill and simply declared that to awaken feeling requires genius and taste. Koch was not alone. The concept of genius was used frequently in musical writings at this time as a means of explaining what would otherwise be inexplicable. In one of the more extended discussions of the subject, Christian Friedrich Daniel Schubart equated musical genius with feeling as opposed to fluency or technical mastery. Other writers followed this same line. The musical genius may have an acute ear and an excellent rhythmic sense, but it is musical sensitivity, his feeling for tones and rhythms, that set him apart. Genius became a fallback position born out of the theorist's inability to fathom some of the mysteries of the musical art. It was their way of saying that melody is all important, but I cannot explain why. They also elevated melody to a position that it did not hold before, but which it would retain in the next century. Thus, through the notion of genius, Enlightenment theorists may seem to have anticipated romantic values. Although Cox and Schubart's conceptions of genius are close to that of the Romantics, one difference was important, and it spoke more to the social rather than the expressive element. Throughout much of the 18th century, creation and performance remained close, and the distinction between performance and composition was not as clear, as most composers wrote for their immediate situation and supervised the performance of their works. Only when performer became separated from composer in the 19th century was it important for the composer to specify precisely what he wanted and the performer to follow his wishes closely. In the 18th century, the performer was a composer even if the piece wasn't his. The situation was comparable to jazz, where the player is given at most a chart or lead sheet and expected to improvise. When a composer such as Corelli published his violin sonatas, they look ridiculously simple in some instances. I don't have any examples here, because Corelli considered his notes only an outline. If anyone has played any of these, they look like all whole and half notes that, you know, any beginner can play, but that's not what's supposed to happen. Bach, by the way, if you look at his pieces, the lines and the notation is very complicated, and he was severely criticized in his lifetime for adding all the ornaments and details of the melody and consequently not giving the performer the opportunity to recreate according to the performer's own aesthetic feeling. So, is Mozart a genius in the Enlightenment view? Yes, he was. Not because he astounded everyone with his ear, with all those stories I mentioned, his memory and technical agility, but because of his feeling for music. When Enlightenment writers spoke of Mozart's genius, they did not refer to his immense facility, but his creativity and taste and musical inspiration. An anonymous writer of the Paris Avant Courrier made this distinction in March 1764. He has all the talent and all the science of a maître de chapelle. Not only does he perform in a surprising manner the concertos by the most celebrated European masters, but he composes himself. He plays from memory for hours together, and giving rein to the inspiration of his genius, he joins the most valuable ideas to the most profound science of harmony. 4 months earlier, Friedrich Melchior von Grimm had used almost the same words in describing Mozart. But what is really incredible is to see him improvise for an hour on end, and in doing so, give rein to the inspiration of his genius and to a mass of enchanting ideas, which moreover he knows how to connect with taste and without confusion. Now, if we take the words that these two writers used, taste, profound, which are facets of musical sensitivity, ideas, that is creativity, and most of all, inspiration. These are what made a genius in the world of the musical Enlightenment. Mozart's facility, I might add, as amazing as it was historically not that unique. There have been a number of other musicians who could do many of the things he did. His creativity and sensitivity and inspiration were. Once when Beethoven had a disagreement with his friend and patron, Prince Lichnowsky, he wrote to him, "There have been many princes, but there is only one Beethoven." To paraphrase Beethoven, "There have been many prodigies, but there is only one Mozart." Maybe the Enlightenment thinkers were on the right track. Though they never could explain the notion of genius with any precision, they sensed what was and what was not important. When dealing with an art as elusive as music, that may be the best that we could expect them to do. Maybe we could do better, or we could go further. Thank you.